turns from present in the past. Every week will be an animated bash. What a cartoon! What a cartoon! Maybe a short but mostly sharp. We'll talk, we'll analyze, exploring as we go. What a cartoon!
Hello, everybody, and welcome to What a Cartoon Movie, the podcast with all the powers of hell. I'm one of your hosts, the guy with an evil bird sidekick, Bob Mackey, and this is an audio exploration of every animated movie ever. Who is here with me today, as always?
Henry Gilbert, though I went by Briar Rose until I turned 16.
And this month's movie is Disney's Sleeping Beauty.
And just before we say goodbye, he takes me in his arms, and then... I wake up.
Yes, and once again on What a Cartoon Movie, we are kicking off the year with our annual look at a Disney classic. So last year we covered Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and this time around we are jumping ahead 20 years to take a look at Sleeping Beauty, a movie that's known for being pretty and not much else, outside of maybe the few Maleficent pictures that would come much later in time.
Maleficent is one of the most celebrated of the Disney villains, maybe the most beloved. She really kind of overshadows this film, but also it is, this movie is a lot thinner than there's very little meat in these gym mats of this film, I came to see.
To quote Red Letter Media, when it comes to Maleficent, what's her story?
Yes, isn't it funny? They did their own Wicked, like that Wicked got so big as a Broadway musical that before then they made a Wicked movie version of it. They did two What If Maleficent Was Elphaba movies.
Yeah, and honestly, her deal in this movie is she didn't get invited to a party and everyone's got to suffer. That's all there is to Maleficent, honestly.
Well, in the new background, I haven't seen either of those movies. I read the plot synopsis for both of them, and I was like, oh, that's it. As a synopsis, it does not seem as an interesting change to her tragic origin story compared to, say, Wicked and what it did for the characters in that.
And another reason this choice is fitting for this month, last year we covered Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, like I said earlier, and the source material is very similar to that movie. In fact, I can't stop thinking about Snow White when I'm watching Sleeping Beauty, and I honestly prefer Snow White, but this is still going to be fun to talk about. I have problems with this movie, but it has some great points to it, and it looks very, very good.
To me, it's basically if you took Snow White and then shoved it together with the Fairy Godmothers, if the Fairy Godmother... from Cinderella got turned into three characters who were also the comic relief.
Mm-hmm. They are having fun with the princess formula. Now, this is a special warning to you free feed listeners or people on the $5 feed at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. At some point, this podcast will cut off, but no, we have not fallen asleep like many beauties before us. We engineered this podcast to cut off, so you will eventually get around to signing up for the $10 tier to hear the rest of this podcast and also 7+ years worth of What a Cartoon Movie episodes. So that's just a warning to all of you. If you are not on the $10 feed, you will not get to hear the entirety of this podcast. You will only get to hear a small portion of the very long history I put together. So again, that is patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. And you can hear episodes about many other classic Disney movies like Bambi, Pinocchio, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and other things like the Disney Renaissance. We've done every movie from there, and then a ton of other movies, so I can't go over them all here, but just so you know, everything is waiting for you at the $10 level at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons.
Yeah, if you're on the free feed, you also just heard we released our first Toy Story one we did, just to let you know how big a long version is. And yes, this episode, consider it like it is cursed by an evil queen that it will go away at a certain point and it can only be expanded to its full version with true love's $10 at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons.
You didn't invite us to your parties and now you're going to suffer. So I want to kick things off by talking about our history with this 1959 film. Henry, what about you?
So with these, I often have fuzzy-ish memories about it, and I have to like check wikis to see when were VHS releases, when were theatrical re-releases. It's this film's theatrical re-releases were pretty limited. Only one of them happened when I was like 13, and I didn't see it then. I did see its VHS release from the 80s, and I think I definitely saw clips of the major moments. on the Disney Channel that like we taped off of for the free weekends. But I definitely remember this as a kid being mainly struck by not the cute animals or the songs, but the violence and being very scared of Maleficent as a little kid. That stuck with me. And it made me really appreciate it from as just an action standpoint. And then as I grew up, I came to really love the artistry on display in it. I thought it's like, it is a really gorgeous, gorgeous film.
Yes. As for me and this movie go back about 3 days because I saw it at the tender age of 43 on January 6th of this year. And you might know this from listening to the podcast, but I have not seen a lot of these classic Disney films. In fact, by doing this podcast, I've been able to watch them for the first time and do a lot of study of them and research them. That's been really great for me because for whatever reason, these were not as accessible to me as other movies, or I just didn't have the interest, or perhaps a little of both. But Sleeping Beauty in particular never really struck me as something I needed to see, at least as a kid, because I thought, well, Sleeping Beauty, you got Snow White. What else do you need? And I know Snow White's good. So yes, I became aware of Maleficent via Kingdom Hearts. Kingdom Hearts made me aware of so many of these other classic movies I had not seen. I only knew like, well, there's Peter Pan and 101 Dalmatians. I don't know what happens in them, but Kingdom Hearts kind of broke me into these classic films that I would eventually see like 20 years later. But yeah, I just saw this movie for the first time 3 days ago. I think it's okay. I agree with the animators in that the art style is conflicting with the storytelling in a lot of ways that make this not the most interesting film to watch, at least on a narrative level, but it is Disney achieving things artistically that the company could not surpass afterwards because this movie lost them a lot of money.
I would kill to see this in 70 millimeter at like off of a classic print of this because already on Disney Plus, the version that's uploaded there, I am assuming it is 4K. It just looks gorgeous. It is as wide as it's ever been. Like I think the Blu-ray release that I most recently watched with a friend about 12 years ago, that might have been in the correct aspect ratio. But like when we were little kids, oh, to think about it being cropped to 4:3,
yeah,
like, oh, it makes me sick inside.
It was hard enough to crop the art to make covers for our podcast. I felt bad doing that. But to imagine watching this entire film in 4:3, in which the film is as wide as three normal CRT TVs placed side by side. I don't know how much they mangled this film, but I'm glad I saw it in this form first. I watched it on Disney Plus. I assume it's at least 1080p, but yes, it is the proper aspect ratio, very, very wide. And yeah, the best way to watch it, I guess, at this point.
When I watched it most recently before this, with my coworker at the time and friend AJ, she was a big Princess fan, but also liked the postmodern viewing of it. And she's the one who pointed out to me something that has really messed up watching this movie for me is that she noticed, and I never noticed it as a kid, she pointed out that, like, seriously, Philip and Aurora don't talk for the last 30 minutes of the film. And when your lead characters in your film, I guess technically the lead characters in your film don't talk, it really makes it a weak story. And it's why it's the fairy godmother's story, not the
really
story
is
of Aurora. Yeah.
Now, I'm going to blow your mind. Sleeping Beauty appears for a total of 18 minutes in the movie named after her. There's like an hour of material that is not Sleeping Beauty. We'll talk more about our feelings about the film as we go on, but I feel like whenever Sleeping Beauty is on the screen, the movie is getting very antsy, like, oh, there's more interesting characters, like these two drunks. And what about the godmother, the fairy godmothers or the fairies? What about Maleficent? They're always like trying to find a way to cut away from Sleeping Beauty.
Yeah, and I feel like Aurora, Briar Rose, like she actually does have an interesting situation if they wanted to deal with it. Like she actually has a more interesting background than we talked about it in the Snow White one. Like Snow White is indefatigable. Like that's just her thing. Like, well, you did try to kill me, but I better just clean up. I'm so glad to clean. Briar Rose, like, I don't know, she actually seems to be attracted to a man and has romantic feelings instead of just, like, falling into a prince like Snow White does.
Yeah, she gets to meet the man she marries ahead of time.
Yeah, yeah. She, in the only part of the movie that gives a shit about either of the characters being the people, I think.
Yes. Yeah. So let's talk about the origins of Sleeping Beauty, and by that I mean the actual original story. So, of course, this comes from a classic folktale named Sleeping Beauty. It has many, many names, but we usually roll with Sleeping Beauty. So a version of this story existed as early as the year 1330, but the one where that's being adapted here comes about 300 years later. And so the source material for this movie can be found in French author Charles Perrault's 1697 fairy tale collection, Stories or Tales from Past Times with Morals. By the way, that is the English translation of the title. I'm not going to read it to you in French, but that is just how clunky book titles were back then. It's like a literal description of the contents.
So it's really supposed to teach kids morals at the end of the day then, right?
Yes. And by the way, I have read all 10 pages of Sleeping Beauty. And he does include like a separate section at the end, like, here is what you should take from the story.
That's funny. It reminds me of when I read the original Little Mermaid, and the ending of it was like, she then turned into like sea foam, and she can only reform herself if little boys and girls are good and listen to their mommies.
Yeah. Yes, these were very, very didactic. So Sleeping Beauty was an existing folktale, but Perrault specifically adapted an Italian version of this story. So that was called Sun, Moon, and Talia, which is collected in a 1634 collection called Il Pentamerone. So he is adapting something that came about 60 years earlier. So I guess he liked that version of the story best, and that's why he zeroed in on that to bring it into the French language.
Okay, so the French stealing from the Italians here. Okay.
And then the English steal from the French, because in 1812, the Brothers Grimm do their version of Sleeping Beauty. So that one is called Little Briar Rose, and that seems to be just as popular as Perrault's French version of Sleeping Beauty. And I feel like people usually roll with the Grimm version. I did not read the Grimm version for this, but I did watch the anime episode of the old anime Grimm's Fairy Tales, and it seems almost one for one with at least the first half of the French story.
Okay, good. Yes, that's I never read Briar Rose either. I watched we both watched Grimm's Fairy Tales a lot, and I was also thinking of that anime version when watching this, because I was like, oh yeah, the anime version easily truncated this into a 30-minute episode of TV.
Yes, because the events that they depict take up about 2 or 3 pages, and that's all you've got to work with Sleeping Beauty. If you don't include the second half of the story, and nobody does. We'll talk more about that in a second, though. Ooh. So, a bit more about Perrault. I think he is a bit underrated in the fairy tale game, because he's also credited with Cinderella, Puss in Boots, Little Red Riding Hood, and Bluebeard. Though, as with many of these fairy tale authors, he was simply taking existing stories and putting them down on the page with a few tweaks here and there. So these are not things he's inventing out of his own brain, but he's like, oh, there are these popular stories. What if I wrote them all down and made a lot of money? And that's what he did.
Wow. Bluebeard's the one basically like the original gaslighting, right? Of the guy that tricks his wife and drives her crazy, like he keeps killing his wives.
I believe so. In that, in the old anime, Grimm's Fairy Tales, that's the one where there's a separate version they had to make because the first version they put on the air was too violent for children.
Yes, yeah, that's my main knowledge of Bluebeard. Though I think we should replace the term gaslighting with bluebearding. I think that's more
fun. Oh, yes. That's more fun to say. So for this podcast, I did read the original version of Sleeping Beauty. It is 16 pages with a lot of illustrations. And whenever we cover something of this vintage, I recommend you go out, find the newest translation, find one with annotations, because a lot of these old translations, they weren't that great, and they also would often censor things that were in the original work because they were put out at a time where people were a lot more, I guess, puritanical, I want to say.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And for this podcast, I did check out the 2009 collection, The Complete Fairy Tales by Charles Perrault, and that is by Oxford University Press. So based on my own research and what was available to me at my library system, that seems like one of the more definitive newer translations of his existing fairy tales.
I would think the Oxford folks would have a lot of good context and localization explanations to give, which, who knows, in some cases those end up being higher word count than the actual story you're reading.
Yeah, in this case there was maybe like 3 annotations that weren't that necessary, but I did still appreciate them. So it was fun to finally sit down and read Sleeping Beauty. So I do want to talk about what happens in the original story, just the few differences. Really, the first half of the story is essentially what every Sleeping Beauty story is about. The second half goes crazy. I do want to mention that too. So I'll mention some big differences, but I'll essentially summarize the story in this next section here. So in the original story, there are 7 fairies, and the original version of Maleficent is a withered old fairy who wasn't invited to the christening because everyone assumed she was dead. And in this version, the original version, she is extra mad. She was not invited. And also, every fairy got a nice little golden cutlery box as a door prize, and they didn't have one for her because they didn't know she was going to show up.
Oh.
So she's extra petty in this original version.
Hey, I like that context that she was just part of the in-group, but the oldest one, and they all just assumed she was dead.
Yes.
Like that, that it gives her more of a backstory than just, nobody wanted you in this movie.
And we still get the spinning wheel curse, but in this case, it's supposed to kill the princess. One of the fairies intervenes and they're like, I can't stop the curse, but I can soften it. So it'll only put the princess to sleep for 100 years. So that's what happens there. It seems like the princess isn't tricked into pricking her finger. It seems like just some old woman in the castle did not hear about the memo, get rid of all the spinning wheels. Although this could also be the fairy in disguise. It's not clear in the original text. But in any case, she pricks her finger, falls asleep for 100 years, and then the castle is overgrown by thorns, and no one can approach it. It becomes a story out of legend. So this is really Sleeping Beauty that is more popular. I've seen this idea used in a lot of like fantasy games, especially JRPGs, the idea of like the abandoned castle where everyone is turned into stone, or something happened in it 1,000 years ago and everyone is frozen. That's exactly what's happening here. In this original source material.
That's like the plot of like a dozen Souls games, is that very idea. Yeah.
I'm thinking of like Dragon Quest VIII and a few other things. Legend of Zelda The Wind Waker, you go back to the original castle, it's underground, it's been protected by a like a dome.
Well, and that 100 years thing too, like that gets like hinted at in this movie as like what Maleficent says she's going to do, but instead it's just like a couple days tops that people are unconscious. But the 100 years thing and the growing of the briars all around it, I like the thorny covering of the building visual.
So the fairy who originally softened the curse, she returns. She puts everyone to sleep for 100 years. So things seem basically just like restart when Sleeping Beauty wakes up. The king and queen leave for some reason. I don't know why, but they're off on their own. And yes, 100 years later, the prince finds her in the castle full of sleeping subjects. And that is essentially what this movie adapts. I mean, there are some differences, but essentially that is the Sleeping Beauty story. A bunch of events happen after the princess and the subjects wake up. So the prince then gets together with Sleeping Beauty, has a few kids with her in this castle, keeps this a secret from his parents for 2 years, but he eventually tells them.
Wow.
And then he moves Sleeping Beauty into his castle, and he becomes the king when his father dies. So in this castle, it is the former prince, now the king. It is Sleeping Beauty, now the queen. And it is the prince's mother-in-law who was once the queen. Excuse me, it's the prince's mother who was once the queen. We get an evil stepmother story next, after the initial events of Sleeping Beauty. So
wow.
It gets a little weird at this point, and sorry if I get the details a little too confusing for our audience, but the prince's mom is part ogre. Now, that's very important to know because she really wants to eat the princess's kids, the Sleeping Beauty's kids. She's like, your kids look tasty. I want to eat them. So the ogress steward says, I'll get those kids and kill them for you, and I'll make them into a great feast. So over the course of the story, the mother's steward, the mother's part ogre, her steward goes out, pretends to kill the kid, but really kills an animal, brings it back to her as a feast, does it again, brings it back to her as a feast. And then the mother-in-law ogre is like, I actually want to eat Sleeping Beauty now. And the steward's like, oh. So he does this one more time. And eventually the mother-in-law ogre catches wise to what's going on. And when she does, she decides to execute everybody by pushing them into a giant cauldron. So this ogre mother-in-law is going to execute her son, her daughter-in-law, and the two children that she never got to eat.
Wow.
But as soon as this happens, as soon as this is going on, this execution, oh, by the way, I already got a detail wrong. The current king, Sleeping Beauty's husband, is off on business or something. So she's going to have Sleeping Beauty and her kids executed while he's gone. But he shows up and he's like, well, what's going on here? And the evil mother responds by jumping in the cauldron and killing herself because apparently a creature is inside of it. And that is the second half of Sleeping Beauty that no one ever adapts because it's weird as hell.
Yeah, that is insane. It's a whole new villain that just appears out of nowhere, who, like, it's just a second story. Like, this has nothing to do with Aurora being asleep. Like, it's a brand new villain. Like,
and she's not called Aurora or Briar Rose in this version. She's just the princess and then the queen. And retelling the events of this become difficult because there is a king, there is a queen, the king dies, the queen becomes just the mother, and then the prince becomes the king, and the princess becomes the queen. So it's hard to keep all the titles straight. But essentially, the prince's mother wants to eat Sleeping Beauty and her children. She is tricked. She tries to kill them, but then she ends up killing herself when she's found out. And that is the second half of the story.
Wow. Also, yeah, the way she takes care of herself seems, I don't know, it feels like somebody wrapping up a short story badly at the end. Like, then she jumps in herself, the end.
And then it ends with the author saying, well, here's two morals you could take from this. One of them is young girls should wait to find a suitable husband because Sleeping Beauty waited for 100 years. You can wait long, can't you? And that is one of the morals, right?
Okay, yeah, I get that. Sure.
And the other moral is, and I'll quote the translation here, lovers lose nothing if they wait and tie the knot of marriage late. So essentially, this means the prince and the princess were being punished for not letting his parents know about their secret relationship and the children. Like, I don't think they had those children under the eyes of God.
Okay. I see. That's what the punishment. Okay. So, though, like, I don't know, the waiting to get married thing, that does feel different than the feeling back then of, like, you can't have a baby after you're like 27. It was the feeling, like, you're an old maid if you're a childless 27-year-old back then.
Yeah, I guess in this 17th century story, he's telling kids, like, don't rush into marriage when you're 14. Wait until you're 16.
And you know what? That's how Disney's Briar Rose also has it all figured out at 16, too.
I think this author was just worried about adults preying on young girls because that's what Little Red Riding Hood is all about, pedophiles.
I mean, yeah, that one's a pretty clear, I don't need a moral at the end to explain to me what the wolf probably represents. Yeah.
A lot of these ancient fairy tales are about watch out for pedophiles because Pinocchio, the thing with Honest John and everything in the original book, it's about, like, don't get into a carriage with a strange man, little boys.
Ooh, geez, man. That's well, this guy, though, now knowing that he also, the same author, Perrault, wrote Bluebeard, it's a lot of, like, two-faced marriages type stuff. A lot of marriage warnings for young ladies.
I mean, honestly, at this time, what else were girls looking forward to but marriage? There's like, my life ends, and then I get married, and then that's the rest of me.
Yeah, I guess that's, if you're writing a princess story for little girls of that era, you're trying to get them prepared to be the happiest wife they could be, I guess.
So yeah, that is the original Sleeping Beauty story, at least the French version, which is credited in the credits for the Disney version. And it's worth reading because it's, like I said, it's 10 pages long. If you've never read Sleeping Beauty, it's worth checking out. And then there's an entire part two to the story that's insane. It's about an ogre who wants to eat Sleeping Beauty and her children.
Compared to when we did Snow White, like, the original Snow White that was sourced was, like, it's a little grislier, but it hits most of the same beats. This is an entirely new ending for it.
And let's talk about the movie now. So I use many sources for this history, but Disney Plus actually has a very nice featurette titled Picture Perfect, The Making of Sleeping Beauty. And I'm sure this was originally a DVD or Blu-ray bonus feature, but it's now on Disney Plus and YouTube. Someone just threw it up on YouTube. And it's a great study of Sleeping Beauty. And many of the living people who were involved with the movie got to comment on it while they were alive.
That's great. The DVD special features are now few and far between, and you celebrate when they get to still live on. Every DVD special feature that they can legally put on Disney Plus should just be on there, and it's dumb. There's only a smattering of them.
Yes, thank God for YouTube, because Disney does not care about these uploads of bonus features from DVDs and Blu-rays. So I often go to YouTube first because it's just honestly easier for me to watch than Disney Plus. You have a lot more options, including the option to download things to your computer. So yeah, I kind of prefer that. So thank you to everyone out there who is preserving these special features, because Disney only wants to preserve some of them. So yes, there's also a DVD commentary that I will have access to before we record the movie portion of this podcast. So I will include details from that in that portion of the podcast. So just a heads up for everybody out there. So we have covered the early history of Disney animated features with our episodes about Snow White, Pinocchio, Bambi, and Dumbo. So please check out more of those podcasts for information on this era. Though we should note that in the late 30s and early 40s, Snow White was the only massive hit for Disney, and they made a lot of miserable failures that are classics today, especially Pinocchio, but especially Fantasia. Nobody cared about those movies at the time. They were very expensive. They made no money. And over time, by shoving them in our faces over and over, Disney eventually turned them into profits. So I'm sure we'll cover this on the podcast at some point, but after the rocky 40s and the propaganda films that kept them afloat, the 50s were a very stable decade for Disney. This is our first 50s Disney film we're covering, and it's actually the last one of the 50s. So I'll just go and name a few of them to let you know what's going on in the 50s. So we have 1950s Cinderella. That was their biggest hit since Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And other films like Peter Pan and Lady and the Tramp ended up being big earners for the studio. So they're finally back on their feet, making successful movies that audiences want to see. Mm-hmm. They're on television. The Disney brand is growing. Disneyland is being built. So 50s, great time for Disney.
I mean, the Disney made a lot of money off of the kids of the 40s, but it really was like once the baby boomer kids started to, you know, be able to watch movies by the early 50s or watch the Mickey Mouse Club on TV, like he was like right there to make every dollar he could. The fractured fairy tales Sleeping Beauty they did is one of my favorite like contemporary parodies of what Walt Disney and Disneyland was. That he's just like, oh, get your e-tickets here, folks. Like he's, God, it's so funny. One of my favorite Jay Ward things ever is that Fractured Fairy Tales.
And you know, I named a bunch of the 50s movies. One I didn't name, Alice in Wonderland. That was actually a failure for the company, surprisingly.
Oh, wow.
That one lost a lot of money. Not as much as Sleeping Beauty, but when I was looking at what earned what, Alice in Wonderland stood out to me as a loss for Disney.
Yeah, they are at the top of their game. Like Cinderella, as I've always heard, and I'm sure we'll cover it someday, I'd always heard that like Cinderella kind of saved the company again, or it was another like, boy, if it wasn't for Cinderella, Disney would be had a very different 50s. And then like artistically, you know, Lady and the Tramp, gorgeous film, Alice in Wonderland, like it was also Disney, I think, paying off decades of his own love of Alice in Wonderland that he'd referenced in many cartoons previous to that and a bunch of shorts. And his live action stuff, that was in Treasure Planet. Treasure Island was in the 50s too. It was the first live action film they had done at Disney. And then those started becoming big successes for them too.
Right, right. This is we're getting into their live action era right here. And yes, like we said earlier, this film, huge failure for Disney. It almost completely derailed any future animated feature film projects. It lost them that much money. It almost sunk the company. Thankfully, they had other ventures they had invested in that were profitable. But this was a bad time for Disney at the end of the decade. The rest of the 50s, smooth sailing. But then Sleeping Beauty kind of ruins it all. And the 60s are a little bit of a mess. But yes, like the other movies that failed, Pinocchio, Fantasia, they eventually become profitable. This movie becomes profitable over the course of time. VHS releases, physical media releases, multiple movie theater releases. They eventually find a way to turn a profit on these massive failures.
Yeah, eventually it gets treated with enough prestige that it they can resell it enough. And plus, if you just consider how it gets repurposed into just not just, you know, toys and whatnot, but the media the theme parks too, like it becomes a big money maker.
And even though Sleeping Beauty was released in 1959, its origins go all the way back to 1938, and that's because Walt Disney saw this as a possible follow-up to Snow White. My guess is he thought the two ideas were way too similar to do back to back, but we can only guess. But that just feels like a logical conclusion to make when you see indeed how these are very similar films.
To think that by the time they finally did make it, it still has so many similar character and plot beats to Snow White. A master story man like Disney, who was very interested in story beats, like he would be like, well, so wait, it's a girl who lives in a cottage, has animal friends she sings to, and then gets put into a sleep, like, huh, and has to be awoken by true love's kiss, or by love's kiss.
In fact, with the whole cottage scenario and the three little helpers, they make the original story even more like their version of Snow White, which is odd to me.
Yeah, yeah. They actually had some stuff that wasn't that close to it, and yet they end up at it. They make her an orphan in a cottage instead.
So if we pull back a bit and look at the timeline of Sleeping Beauty, We can see that some preliminary work was done as early as 1950, but then Walt gets distracted by Disneyland, an amusement park project on a scale that no one had ever seen before. So that is a really good excuse to get distracted. The building of Disneyland, I can buy that.
Yeah. It just turned 70 this year. Nothing existed like it before. It is an extremely American achievement for capitalism, for sure. I love Disneyland, so I can't be too hateful on it or I'd be a phony. But I have watched probably 40 hours of, like, how did Disneyland get made videos on both YouTube and official Disney propaganda.
It is fascinating. We'll talk about the various, like, fits and starts this production went through, but work in earnest really began in 1956, and the movie released in early 59. So this explains why, for a very long time, it was the most expensive animated movie ever made. It essentially took almost a decade of production, starts and stops, and then about 3 years of nonstop production for this to get over the finish line.
Well, and sorry if this gets ahead on that too, but with Disneyland, it opens in 55, but they must have been committed to doing the Sleeping Beauty movie because the castle is Sleeping Beauty's castle. It's identified as that from the beginning. They didn't, like, name it afterwards as Sleeping Beauty's castle. So, like, hey, here's the castle in Disneyland. That's Sleeping Beauty's castle, when you'll see that in theaters eventually.
Yeah, I think probably they assumed, well, when this is built, the movie will be right around the corner. But then that castle existed for about 3.5 years before the movie actually came out in theaters.
Yeah. And now you can walk through. There's always a line for it. I've actually never done it out of the many things I've done in Disneyland. In the castle, they do have, it's not like a ride. It's more of just like a series of dioramas telling the story in stained glass form of the movie.
I've never done that either, but I didn't know that was there.
No, it's one of those things of like, oh, that just looks like a door, probably to nothing. Maybe the janitor uses it. And then you later find out, like, oh, no, that was a line. You could have walked in there.
It's a whimsical bathroom. So, yes, it seems like Sleeping Beauty was greenlit in 1950 because there was so much pre-release buzz behind Cinderella that Disney thought, okay, you like princesses. Here's another famous one. Let's get started on Sleeping Beauty. But then many, many things happen. And like Cinderella, this is also sort of a rags-to-riches story, although with Sleeping Beauty, it's a riches-to-rags-to-riches story. So yeah. Not as relatable.
No, Cinderella suffers a lot more. Like, the worst thing that happens to Briar Rose is she's told she can't marry a man she just met. While Cinderella has been tortured her whole life by a wicked stepmother and stepsisters. Like, she suffers not unlike Christ on the cross and earns her, you know, castle in the sky.
Exactly. So Walt envisioned this film as one of pure spectacle, and his idea was, with 2 decades of work under their belt, his animators would finally be able to deliver on what he wanted audiences to see. So he saw his previous films as, you know, interesting artistically, but in terms of the vision he wanted to display, kind of failures. But he thought, we've been working at this for so long, this will be the culmination of all of our artistic training and performance and everything, just everything up there on the screen for viewers to see. So this had very lofty goals from the beginning.
I can see why he'd at least want to dream really big for it, because by that point, his 2 biggest hits, at least theatrically, have been a princess movie in Snow White and a princess movie in Cinderella. So if they're going to get back to another princess, like, now a Disney princess is a very trademarked term.
Yeah.
But Aurora would just be the third, like, true Disney princess, right? I think.
I think so. Yeah. I think it's just those 3 to begin with here. Snow White, Cinderella, and Sleeping Beauty. So like many Disney features before this one, Sleeping Beauty went through many changes before reaching its final form that we know today. And thanks to the 2003 DVD release, we have access to the 1951 outline, which details a very different version of this classic tale that we can watch on Disney Plus today. So you can read the whole thing for yourselves, but I'll at least talk about a few of the more notable differences here. So number 1, Aurora is a much better character, at least in my opinion. So she grows up in the family castle and she longs to see the outside world. And this curiosity is where all the trouble starts. So she's kind of like a Jasmine figure The original idea for Sleeping Beauty.
A little bit of The Little Mermaid, too, of just like being interested in something that could harm her as well from overprotective parents.
Yeah, it gives her a goal from the beginning and not just like, well, I guess I live in this cabin with three old ladies and that's kind of my life.
I have animal friends and you know what? I'm a little flighty and if you dream something twice, it must come true.
It's true. And so the setup is mostly the same, but in this case, Aurora is forbidden to leave the castle because Maleficent creates this silver spinning wheel that can't be destroyed. And every night, people can hear it spinning away in the dark forest. So, yeah, there's the snubbed invitation for Maleficent, the curse that happens, and then in this case, Sleeping Beauty is not put in a cottage with three old fairies. She is kept in the castle and forbidden to leave.
Boy, the all of this anti-spinning wheel stuff in this story, I feel like it got sponsored by Big Loom instead.
She's like a mule with a spinning wheel. So we get a classic Prince and the Pauper scenario with this story because Aurora trades places with a maidservant, or maybe like an episode one, The Phantom Menace scenario.
Oh, just like that. Okay, yeah. She's just like how Queen Amidala trades places with one of her handmaidens played by Kira... Keira Knightley, yeah.
Keira Knightley, right. Was it Shmi or Shmoo?
Oh, yeah. No, Shmi is the name, that's the name of Anakin Skywalker's mother.
Oh, okay.
Shmi. Yeah, Shmi Skywalker.
How stupid. Well, yes, she trades places with a maidservant so she can go out to the city, and that's where she meets the prince, and this is where they fall in love. So they don't meet in a forest. He meets her as a pauper. So I guess she's kind of like a pauper living in the forest in the final version of the movie. But it's important that he's not just in love with her because she could potentially have money.
That is an improvement 20 years later after Snow White of just like, hey, Snow White, a prince showed up and said he wants to marry you. Better do it. This at least takes some, I think, in consideration some of the criticisms of like, no, Philip fell in love with a woman who he doesn't even know is a princess. So you know it's true love and not just a political or self-interested move of his.
And then Maleficent takes over the castle post-finger prick, and rumors spread about this thorn-covered castle. The prince eventually arrives to kiss Sleeping Beauty. 100 years do not pass, and there is no dragon battle. Meriwether simply zaps the Maleficent with a lightning bolt, and it causes her to fall, which breaks the spinning wheel and the curse. So there is no grand confrontation between the prince and Maleficent. It is all fairy magic, although I will argue... the fairies do all of that work in the final battle to the point where they're like, let's just make them invincible.
Yeah, no, I'll complain about it in the regular thing, but the fact that the killing blow isn't even Philip, like she does it, like it's a blessing on it. Like that bugged me. Like Philip, as Martin would say about the driver of his stock car race, he's like, the driver is basically ballast. Like,
yes.
Prince Philip is basically ballast.
He's along for the ride here. So I should note that at some point early on, there were 7 instead of 3 fairies. So it seems at some point.
On.
Yeah, I mean, the original story had 7, so I can see where that's coming from. 7 is a very like magical, mystical number that it has a lot of connotations. But yes, early on, there were 7 of these fairies instead of 3. So it seems like at some point Walt Disney really wanted to outdo Snow White. Like, we're going to have 7 things in this one, but they're going to look even better.
Well, even that lightning bolt ending, like, that's basically how the evil witch is killed in Snow White as well. Like, a lightning bolt, basically God just zaps her from the sky, and so she falls off the cliff.
The dwarves expose her to the Lord, and then the Lord's like, thanks, guys, I'll take over from here.
If it had been 7 fairy godmothers in this, or 7 fairies, there could have been extended lore stuff of the 7 fairies falling in love with the 7 dwarves. Like, it could have been the Chipettes to the Chipmunks here.
They weren't thinking of crossovers at this point. So, yes, this came into being, this original treatment. Walt Disney rejects it because it feels like it's too similar to Snow White and the 7 Dwarfs. So, and Cinderella. So here's a quote from Walt himself looking back at the production of Sleeping Beauty. So to quote Walt, quote, "We had a lot of problems. We were fighting to break away from what we had done in the past. Sleeping Beauty was tough because it had many of the elements we had already used in Snow White and Cinderella. You've got to give the creators new things to work with so they'll be able to keep their enthusiasm up. You're in trouble if they start saying, haven't we done this before? We had to find out what we had and whether it would please the public. I'm never sure myself what they're going to buy." End quote. Like I said earlier, it's funny because despite Walt's attempts to make this story different from Snow White, it just keeps reminding me of Snow White when I'm watching it.
In their heads, they're like, guys, we got it. I make it not like Snow White. And then in the thing, you see that they spent millions of dollars and years of the best people at the Disney company to be like, let's not make it like Snow White. You're watching it like, boy, this has a lot of moments from Snow White and many parts that don't remind me of Snow White then just remind me of Cinderella.
Yeah. Unfortunately, and it doesn't help that Maleficent is played by the woman who plays the evil stepmother in Cinderella.
Yeah, I mean, she rules, and I love her voice for it, but yeah, you shouldn't bookend the 50s with very similar evil ladies with the same actress, perhaps.
And they're literally like referencing footage they've taken of that actress doing her lines. So it essentially is the same actor.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That makes sense. There are several moves she does that also remind me of the Wicked Stepmother, too. Yeah.
So by 1952, many months were spent fully figuring out Sleeping Beauty, the story itself, and Walt himself was present in these story meetings. And their chief problem was making Aurora a distinct princess character, and their solution was to make her unaware of her lot in life and to make her more modern by 1959 standards, mind you, compared to the princesses that had come before. So she seems very old-fashioned when you're watching this today, but she, I guess, is not just a passive object in the story. For a portion of it, she falls in love. She has desires. She's not just a corpse a person finds and kisses.
Yeah, yeah. She also, if she's sad, she doesn't then instantly go like, but I shouldn't be sad. I should sing a happy tune. Like she has a lot more to her life. The splashes of this that were most interesting to me for Aurora and Philip is when it feels like they are a slight commentary on teenagers. And in the 50s, the idea of a teenager is a kind of a new thing. Like, so when characters like Philip say like, come on, dad, it's the 14th century, like get modern. Yeah. Like those are the fun moments where it feels like they're actually channeling thoughts about the kids who buy Elvis records and waste all their money on learning to do the twist.
Yes, exactly. I was thinking the exact same thing when I was watching this. Like, oh, this is a commentary on the new idea of teenagers, because now we don't have world wars anymore. Now, when you are a teenager, you don't have to get a job. You're in school. You can have, all these interests. Like you can buy movie magazines. You can you can watch the television. There's a whole new subculture of people out there.
And you know, Walt Disney, I'm sure, being an old-fashioned guy with teenagers of his own, probably had his reasons he would be annoyed at them. But also, like, them buying Davy Crockett hats or why he could build Disneyland. Like, teenagers were very good to Walt Disney.
And even though they tried to work on Aurora, you can definitely feel in the final film they're very uncomfortable with her and how she could be perceived as similar to previous princesses, which is why, again, she is not present in an hour of this film, an hour of this 75-minute film.
Yeah, and she's never in princess mode, and she never talks. She's asleep or a baby for a whole lot of the movie, all the pivotal moments. And even her, like, you would ask for some introspection of, like, how does Aurora feel about being raised by these three women? And she doesn't seem to mind them, but also isn't that interested in her, what is essentially her mother's.
Yeah, like there are no questions by Aurora. I would be asking, are there other people?
Yes. Why do I live here? She is beyond homeschooled. Like she has never met another person other than three magical creatures pretending to be humans who are all kind of goofy.
Mm-hmm. Very silly old ladies. So a lot of ideas were kicked around, and I don't want to bog this history section down by listing all of the differences or different versions. So I will mention more of these details in the movie discussion segment to follow the history segment. Before we zoom in to look at particular artists who contributed to this film, I do want to stay zoomed out and still examine the production as a whole. So as far as the look of Sleeping Beauty, the very iconic look of this film, I'm not entirely sure when this aspect was decided upon, but a huge moment of inspiration came when Disney artist John Hench saw a display of the famous unicorn tapestries at a museum in New York City. So these famous tapestries were made towards the end of the medieval period in what is now Belgium and exist as a series of tableaus. So I would ask you now, go ahead and Google them because I really can't describe what they look like. But if you Google these images, you can see how they inspired the look of Sleeping Beauty. This and about like four other different art styles are all being pushed into this one singular art form that Sleeping Beauty is told through.
I mean, cracking the nut on the art form is the thing that makes it most stand out from their previous princesses. Like they, oh yeah, I see it now. I've pulled him up on my own phone here as we talk. Yes.
Yes. You can see them all online, obviously, but yes, he saw these, John Hench saw these in person. It's like, okay, this is a nice look for our next movie. We should use this as a springboard. So it's not just that. So it's a mix of late medieval art as well as Persian art and Japanese art. And also, Disney was influenced by the UPA style, which was formed by people who left Disney. So this is seen in their 1953 short, Toot, Whistle, Plunk, and Boom. So much of the appeal of Sleeping Beauty is seeing what UPA could have done with $6 million instead of, I don't know, $50,000?
Well, Warner did it too. A lot of people did it after UPA won a couple of Oscars. Their competitors who they decided, well, we can make a UPA type thing too. We can have bolder colors and more like primary colors and simpler backgrounds. Like, yeah, this certainly wouldn't look the way it looks with its bold colors and choices if it wasn't for UPA.
So yes, it's a mix of late medieval art, Persian art, Japanese art, and UPA art. And I have very little art history knowledge, so maybe someone can step in and say this in a more eloquent way, but what they're going for is rather non-representational. You look at Sleeping Beauty and you say, that is beautiful, even though it does not look like what a real landscape would look like if I saw it with my eyes. The trees aren't shaped like this. The landscape doesn't look like this. There are not these like blocky chunks of like mountains in the way that Sleeping Beauty depicts them, but it's still beautiful in its own way. And they are really leaning into like the postmodern 50s style while relying on these older art styles. It is a really huge mix of various different influences, which is why this movie looks so unique.
Yes, I mean, just looking at the landscapes going across it, the trees, the castle, the cottage, like all of these things, like it's so much more representational, or like you said, postmodern, or just it lets you understand, like, well, you know what a tree looks like. Let's abstract it as much as possible, but still have you know that it's a tree and you understand it. Like, and I also love the character design of the people too. Like, everybody has very sharp features, except for the fairies, I guess, really. But even like just sharp chins, sharp noses, like just very, very strong angles on characters.
Yeah, it's really veering away from the realism he demanded in things like Pinocchio and in Snow White, outside of the very cartoony characters. He wanted things to be as realistic as possible. Here, he's decided, let's go Pomo. Let's totally make this a fun, weird post-war experiment with all these many different art styles. So credit him for being progressive in that way instead of being old-fashioned. So the look is approved, and this is when artist Avan Earle steps in as the color stylist and the art director. And we'll talk a bit more about him later, where he came from, what else he did. And it sounds like he was given a lot of control because Disney really loved Mary Blair's stylized work, but he felt that something was lost when it was translated to the screen, mostly because the animated characters still had traditional Disney designs. Instead of putting Mary Blair in a position of power like that, he's like, what if a guy did it? Hey, Avan, come on over here. You're art director on this movie. We want the characters as stylized as Mary Blair's art.
I'm interested to hear that because in my memory, I was like, oh, this is very Mary Blair, because I really love her art style. Like, you see it, for example, in the Small World ride, It's a Small World. Like, that is so gorgeous, her color choices in it. And it does make me sad that it's like, oh, yeah, this very singular woman and her style, like that everybody loves. Hey, you guy, you take it. She can't be in charge of this.
Yes. It was mostly Alice in Wonderland. He thought, well, I loved her designs for Alice in Wonderland, but the artist could not translate them correctly. Let's have someone else do it.
Yes. Yeah. That is too bad. Man, that makes me want to do Alice in Wonderland next time. I don't know. As January 2027, but who knows? But
I have not seen that one either. So that'll be a first time for me. Yes. You should not be surprised. I have not seen Peter Pan. I have not seen Lady and the Tramp. I have not seen Cinderella. I can keep going.
Okay, I'll stop. You're going to make me overgasp.
Listen here, Mr. Clamshell. All right, I'm going to move on here.